This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. The show is hosted by Marco Arment. He is the creator of Instapaper. I'm Dan Benjamin. We would like to very quickly say thanks to our beloved sponsors, FieldNotesBrand.com and iStockPhoto.com, which we'll tell you about as the program goes on. This is episode number 31. So how's your week been going?
Oh, boy. It's been...
What's Brooklyn like this time of year?
Its database server is down. It's been a lot of fun stuff with web hosting.
You've been detailing some of this on both your blog, Marco.org, as well as on the Instapaper blog itself. And it seems like the FBI never really had your server.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds like they took... And I don't know anything about this Blade equipment. I've never actually seen it, and I've never bought it.
You just knew you had a physical server somewhere. You didn't really care what you know. You knew it had the stats you needed. That was enough, and that's enough for pretty much everybody.
Right, and I knew it was a Blade, and so I knew there were a bunch of them kind of lined up. I assume vertically in this big thick enclosure that looks like a bunch of rack servers stacked on top of each other. And from what people have told me, the C7000 is actually the enclosure that goes around all the blades. And so I had one of those blades inside of the C7000 was my computer. And the blade holds two disks, but the two disks that I had on my server were not the internal ones, but rather were in a separate disk enclosure that was just connected by a big SAS cable to my blade. Apparently, the FBI did not take the disk enclosure that my disks were residing in.
Now, does that make you think that there must have been another disk enclosure then somewhere else that they took?
Presumably. It sounds like they only took the one C7000 enclosure. From what I can gather from... And, you know, the communication from them is all through their CEO, who is clearly not a native English speaker. So it's a little unclear. Sometimes he uses odd wordings, and sometimes you have to kind of interpolate what you think he means. So I think they only took one enclosure that contained 16, I think, blades or 20 blades, and apparently either they didn't take the hard drives they were looking for, or the server that they were targeting was using its internal hard drives, which I think is more likely. So we'll see. Because I was using like the big 2 terabyte disks. Maybe they didn't make those in the 2.5 inch size required by the server. I have no idea. But whatever the case, if I'm understanding this guy correctly, they took my server's blade, which is the CPU, the RAM, the motherboard, but they did not actually take its disks, which. You know, fine, they can have the blade. I don't know. That's not really anything.
Right. All you cared about was the data on the drives. You could care less about... I mean, you cared in that it interrupted service to some degree.
Right, exactly.
But you didn't care. The fact that they went and got the hardware, who cares?
Right.
Take the hardware. Yeah. We don't care.
Yeah. The hardware was just an inconvenience. The data was more of like the violation and the intrusion. So I think that's done. I haven't heard anything more about it. I canceled my account with Digital One, and I'm pretty sure that's done. And so right now, actually, Instapaper's down, but that's because the private net interface on its database server is down for some unknown reason at SoftLayer, and they're working on it.
What a hassle.
Isn't this fun? I love websites.
Well, I asked you over email, I guess it was a few days ago, maybe it was earlier in the week. Were people really upset? Because, I mean, really, if you think about Instapaper, I mean, clearly, if the service went down, there are going to be a lot of people who are upset about that because it's a service that people rely on. Many people have paid to use it in one way or another. So it's a service. It's a service interruption. I could see them being upset. But it's not like you're storing. I mean, certainly, when there is a privacy violation, people are concerned because most people or many people consider any kind of data that they have to be private. In other words, anything that they have that's theirs, even if they just drew a little picture of a happy face and put it on an envelope, that's theirs. They don't want anybody else to see that or know about it. So
But really, I mean, who was upset besides you? I mean, obviously, you wouldn't want them to have your whole code base and everything else. But was it just a big privacy concern? Why would people be upset that, oh my gosh, maybe somebody could see my, you know, things I've saved? Like, was that a big deal, and why?
I don't think most people cared, but certainly some people cared a lot. And you know, one person likened it to like if you suddenly learn that the government was watching all the books you got out of the library. You know, it's like here's some
that bothers a whole lot of people,
right? And understandably, like if you think about it, that is, you know, you assume that this is like, you know, just being kept between you and the service provider. You assume like the government, the big scary government, is not looking at it. And you start thinking like, you know, could they use this against me somehow? Like, did I read anything that could be considered anti-government? And you know,
why was I reading the Anarchist Cookbook every night for an hour?
Right, exactly. So it's definitely a big intrusion in your privacy, and especially when it's not expected. You know, the funny thing is, Instapaper has still, when the service launched, I didn't even require passwords. You can just type in your email address or a username or anything. No password, just give me some kind of username to keep track of your stuff, and that's it. And a pretty big portion of user accounts on Instapaper still have no passwords, even though I started requiring them about 6 months ago. And I, you know, I started prompting for them even before that, but I started really requiring them about then. And if your account doesn't have a password, you can still use the app and you can still save pages. But if you try to enter the website, the web interface, into the unread page and all those pages, it'll prompt you to enter a password and require you to before you can get in.
So what could somebody do? I mean, take people back. Maybe they're new to Instapaper or something. What were people doing without a password? What could you do? All you were doing was saying, I want to read this. You were using the whole service then.
Yeah, the whole service did not require passwords. That's actually one of the biggest reasons why it got big, because a lot of the influential blogs early on picked up on that as, hey, this is kind of a cool idea. Look how simple this registration form is. It's literally just one field, just the username, and that's it. Then you're registered. And that got Instapaper popular. Like, if it weren't for that, it probably wouldn't be what it is today.
Why did you change it?
That's a really good question. I wrote a big blog post about it a few months back. Basically, I made two changes. I changed it so that the usernames had to be email addresses. Before, it could just be pretty much any text string, but I required them to be email addresses, and I required passwords to exist. The bigger reason for the passwords was there's two reasons. One is that I really did want some kind of security as I was making more complex features like being able to see what other people liked on their accounts and had that minor social element to it. I wanted, because that starts giving people a reason to spread around their username a bit. And once you have a reason to publicize your username, then obviously you need some kind of security so that only you can get to it. So that was a big reason. But the bigger reason was just support. It turns out, as much as I was trying to be clever in allowing people to enter anything as a username and no password or any password, it turns out people are accustomed to having their email address be their login name and to having a password. And if you change that up a bit, and if you give them more flexibility, then they have to start getting confused and thinking, wait, did I give this a password? What is my username? Did I use my email address, or did I use like a username portion of it? Especially with non-geeks, this is a big issue. Like if their email address was danbenjamin@gmail.com, and a field asks them for their username or email address, they might just enter Dan Benjamin.
Right.
Because they don't really, you know, they don't know, well, what's my username? I don't know. I know what my email address is. And so a really big problem is that people would have two different accounts accidentally. They would accidentally create both of those and then not know which one they were saving to at any given time and seem like it wasn't working properly. And sure enough, I recently finally had to build an account merge tool, because even from before I made this transition, there are so many people who have both. And then I'd get an email saying, this is one of the most common support emails I get. Get an email saying, hey, I want to sign up with my email address, but it says it's taken. That's impossible. It can't be taken. It's my email address. And yeah, it turns out like at some point they accidentally registered it in the past and didn't realize, and of course quickly forgot. So it was a big problem for support and for you know the user perception of the service. If they're confused by it or if it appears that it's not working, that's pretty bad for me. So I changed both of those things to make it more like regular web services. It also turns out this is useful for developers. I was under the impression that the best reasonable practice for storing passwords was to hash them and store the hashes.
Right.
And that the best hash to use in general was just like a SHA-1 with a salt, basically. It was good enough. It turns out the purpose of the salt is to defeat rainbow tables.
And what are rainbow tables?
That's a really good question. A rainbow table is basically it's like a database of hash values. It's like just by brute force, like what every hash, like here's some words that every hash value maps to. And so the you know they're like gigs and gigs of text, and you can basically say like if a service does not use a salt, if the password that they store is just the MD5 value of the password you entered, then somebody can, if they somehow come into possession of the hashes, they can reverse engineer that. They can take this hash and say, well, here's all the words that hash to this. And then, you know, there's usually not that many of them are suitable passwords or likely passwords. They can pretty much guess your password based on that, and then they can go test it and figure it out. And then if they have your password to one site and your email address to that one site, they can assume that a lot of people use the same email and password on multiple sites, so they can go try like various big banks and PayPal and other things that could really cause harm. So salt is used to basically tweak the hashes so that they're only really hashes in the context of your service. There's a good way to do salt and a simple way to do salt. The simple way is to just append a certain known string onto the end of the password string that you're hashing.
In your case, it's Brooklyn.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. And then there's also a few different algorithms, like there's the HMAC procedure that I'm not entirely familiar with. I know I've called it in code, but I don't know how it works. But it's all doing basically the same thing, where it adjusts the input value for the most part, so that somebody would have to create a rainbow table just for your service to know, well, when this string is entered and combined with this other string, then it produces this hash. Mm. And to do that, to even know what those strings are, they need to have a copy of your source code. Although in this case, if my initial assumption had turned out correct, which is that the FBI had both the code and the data, then they could have generated this.
Yeah, they can have all that.
What's different now, And so as long as that was the case, as long as that was the attack vector, you know, rainbow tables and generation of these things, then salting was a pretty good idea, because it was a pretty effective way to make sure that your password hashes weren't that easily figured out. But the problem is that computers got a lot faster since that was common practice. So what happened is that, first of all, GPUs became programmable, and so you have these computers on your graphics cards, these massively parallel processors that can't do a lot of different tasks, but what they can do in parallel, lots of times per second, much much faster than a general purpose CPU can. So, what happened is people started being able to program these things to do SHA-1 and MD5. And so suddenly it became very, very easy and fairly inexpensive to generate millions of hash values in a very short amount of time. So rainbow tables are kind of out of date now. They aren't really necessary anymore, because now anybody with like a gaming graphics card can just brute force it basically so quickly that even a salted hash, if they have the salt, then they can generate the rainbow table in, you know, effectively in memory,
right,
in seconds or minutes. So The problem is now that the hashes are simply too fast. So the best practice, as I was very quickly informed once I said I was using Salted SHA-1, the best practice now is to use a very slow hash. And the most commonly recommended one is bcrypt, which uses the Blowfish encryption scheme mechanisms of in some way to generate a one-way hash. So it's kind of a bad name, you know, and it might mislead people into thinking that you're storing the passwords, but no, it's still just a hash, because you don't want to store the passwords in plain text for many reasons, obviously. Because then if somebody steals your database, then they don't have to do any kind of cracking. They just have the passwords, and they can go try them in other places directly. So bcrypt is it's a hash with an adaptive workload. So you can specify a number of, like, how slow you need it to be. And so I deployed it last night, and it's really very simple. And I most of the sample code for it is outdated, and relies on lots of different hacks to get around limitations in earlier versions of PHP. But if you can require PHP 5.3, you can do it with almost no code whatsoever. I'm going to post, we'll link to it in the show notes, I'm going to post about what this code is. You basically use the crypt function in PHP. So my implementation of it last night that I deployed to Instapaper is it's about 7,000 times slower than SHA-1 was. And if it turns out that my servers can handle this, because I'm not computing password hashes on every request. I'm only computing them when you're logging in,
right,
or changing your password effectively or checking it. I'm currently using a work factor of 6, which is it's a power. It's 2 to the 6th iterations of something in the hash. So if I change that work factor to 7, then it becomes twice as slow. And you can put values there up to 31. So you can get things quite slow if you need them to be. And the idea then is, over time, as computers get faster, you can just raise that number. So as you get faster servers, as faster processors come out, you just make your passwords slower and slower and slower, and it's backwards compatible, so all the old ones will still work. If I raise that from 6 to 7, all the ones generated so far at 6 will still continue to work, because it encodes that 6 in the value. So it's a pretty good system. This is bcrypt. It's pretty awesome. And I always like learning about best practices in web development, because people don't often talk about some of the low-level stuff like this. A lot of people will tell you, how to put labels in your checkboxes in your forms. By the way, please put labels in your checkboxes in your forms. That's important. I like being able to click the label and have
you just
want to
click the word. You just want to click the words. You don't want to have to click the words and then say, I get a gun and then go over and click the box.
Right. In addition to all the accessibility benefits and everything else. But anyway, I really do enjoy learning about this low-level stuff like password storage and things like that, because people don't often talk about it, and a lot of people don't need to deal with it directly. It's done by a framework or something.
So our first sponsor today, this show is brought to you by Field Notes Brand, made in the USA memo books and more, now featuring the American Tradesman edition. This is a limited release for summer. It's sturdy and reliable, and it comes with the most awesome carpenter pencil you've ever seen. So get one and then build something that will last 100 years. It's available individually and as part of a yearly subscription, which I highly recommend. You can use the coupon code HEARDITFROMDAN, all one word, and you will save $25 on the subscription. Do this now at fieldnotesbrand.com. I'm not writing it down to remember it later. I'm writing it down to remember it now.
We got to talk about this Final Cut Pro 10 thing a little bit.
Are you a big Final Cut Pro user?
No, I've actually never used it. A long time ago, I pirated Final Cut Express to see if that could do something I wanted to do, and I couldn't figure it out, and so I just deleted it. That was back when I pirated things. Sorry, world. They're facing an interesting problem here. Whenever you have... So, okay, let me step back for a second. normally it's tricky to try to listen too much to your pro users. Like if you have a product, there's going to be like some people who push the boundaries, the pro users, people who use it more often than others or who use it harder than others. They break certain limits.
Sure.
So like in Instapaper's case, it could be like somebody who has like 50,000 items saved in Instapaper. You know, most people don't have anywhere near that. But if you have like 50,000 items, then like you have a different set of problems than the average customer who only has a few hundred, you know, or whatever the number is. I don't even know. So if I listen too much to feature requests and to priorities and other demands from people who are those pro users, they might request things and you know, features and changes and so on that are only really going to apply to them. And it's not really going to help the rest of the user base. So, you know, to some extent, listening to them it can be pretty expensive because, you know, they're just going to request things that no one else is ever going to run into, no one else is ever going to use. The downside is that if you ignore them, you might be ignoring your best customers. And you know, like the question is, why are they hitting these limits? Are they hitting these limits because they're just kind of using it wrong? Or because they're using it best. And these might be your best customers that you are ignoring or frustrating by not paying more attention to them. And they also might be your biggest evangelists. Like if you please the best customers, maybe they're the ones most likely to tell their friends and tell the public to use your stuff. So you have to look at your customer base and weigh out these factors and see, like, you know, of these people who are making these demands or who are slowing down the servers when they hit them or who are requesting features that are useless, like, that are useless to everyone else. You know, do I need to listen to that? Are they gonna, like, do I really need to keep them happy? And so, you know, it varies depending on what your product does and what this, like, what these edge case uses are there for. But In the case of content creation and high-end content creation apps, basically anything by Adobe and any of Apple's apps that come in black interfaces, so Aperture, Final Cut, and then I don't know, like Logic and all those, are those all Apple? I don't know anything about this, most of these industries, so...
Yeah, you've got Logic, you've got Final Cut Pro, and they used to all be the Pro Tools family, which is what you're talking about. That's sort of different now, but...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think they've kind of dissolved that name, but I don't know. Anyway, so in that kind of market, and developers to some extent too, like Xcode is one of these as well, where it's not just like an average consumer tool. In that market, a lot more of the people are going to have those weird pro edge cases because a lot more of them are using these like for work in a commercial setting, often pushing the boundaries and pushing the limits very hard. That's one of the it's a smaller group of people using them, no question. That's why you can charge $1,000 for these programs, because you're not selling to every single person. You're selling to people who need these to do their jobs properly and who have built complex workflows around them over time. And you know, the last thing they want to do is learn something new while they're just trying to get a job done. They're just, you know, they have stuff to do. They don't have time to learn new things about your program every day. And so these kind of pro tools tend to be extremely resistant to change in their user base, their user bases tend to be resistant to change because, you know, like a new version of Xcode came out, and we've talked about this before, like I wanted to wait until after I was done with a major release before I switched to Xcode 4 because I knew there was going to be a big learning curve and some things weren't going to work right, and you know, it was going to be a big burden on me to switch to the new version of this app. But in this case, with Final Cut Pro 10 or X, is it, what am I supposed to say? Am I supposed
you
to
know,
say
we went over this on the talk show too, and I believe the correct, they want you to say 10. I'm hearing a lot of people say X. I don't care. I'm not going to correct you on it. I get everything wrong anyway. Whatever, we can just sort of set the parameters for the context of this show and run with it.
It's 20,011. All right. So, Final Cut X Pro 10, whatever. it's more like a reboot of the line. They changed a ton of stuff about it, lots of fundamental things. In the pro market, in this content creation, professional, high-end tool market, that amount of change is always going to generate tons of negative feedback from people who say, I don't know where anything is, I can't work with this, I don't have time to learn this. Maybe they don't recognize it as that, but usually that's the fundamental reason why they don't like it at first, is because it's different and it's a learning curve and they don't have time. So that's usually the issue. In this case, they definitely have that, but they also have other problems with this. The big backlash to Final Cut Pro 10 has been mostly it's lacking a really, really important feature that I need for my business, because it actually does less in some areas than the previous version. And this is, again, this is a problem we've talked about in the past as well. Like, what do you do when you want to remove a feature? In this case, Apple has removed a lot of features and some really important ones. And I read this great blog post. I'll have to dig it up for the show notes. But it said, like, you know, it's not that – it was from a professional video editor, and I'm sure you've seen a million of these this week. And it said, like, it's not that we don't like this. It's that we actually can't use this. We can't use this tool because it's lacking all these features that we really do need. It's not like the whiny kind of, oh, I need this, you know, because you just don't want to change. No, it's we actually, like, there's a real need for this feature or this way of doing things that you've just killed, and therefore we can't use your product. So, and Apple released their kind of PR fact the other day about, you know, here's common questions about, answers to questions about Final Cut, and it was mostly unhelpful. It didn't really address most of the major shortcomings of things like the track exports that certain editing houses said that they need for certain standards and the import and export of the XML and things like that. It didn't really give good answers to these things, or at least the answers people wanted. I think, and you guys did a big thing on the talk show about this yesterday, which I haven't fully listened to, but I got a little bit of the way in so far, and it sounds like you guys covered this pretty well, so I'm not going to go over too much of the details, but the big problem here is that Apple did a really ballsy thing by releasing this in its kind of unfinished state. You know, they said, like, oh, we're going to add multicam support in the next version. That, I don't know if that was in reaction to the negative feedback or that they just wanted to get it out the door and cut that for version 10, but are going to add it in 10.1. That sounds as though they rushed this out. And there's really not a lot of reason to rush out tools in this type of market. Like these pro tools, there's usually not a lot of mainstream press about them. You're not really coordinating the launch of anything around them. You know, these are pro tools. They usually are on much slower release cycles than consumer tools, maybe every 18 months or more even. So I don't really know what reason they would have had to rush this out. And a lot of the problems that they're facing are just because certain third-party plugins don't work. And a lot of that's because the new one is 64-bit, and they have to run all their plugins in the new architecture, and so they need to do that change, and they need to wait on plugin vendors to make that. And that's fine. That is not really Apple's fault. Although I don't know how much time they gave the plugin makers to do this and how long ago these makers had some kind of beta access to this. They might not have had it for very long, so I don't know. But that's not really Apple's problem, or rather, it is their problem. It's not really their fault. So they'll get around that eventually. You know, give it a couple of months, and I'm sure there'll be enough plugins for this that it'll be okay. But in regard to, like, lacking entire features and export options and ways of doing things, some of these things are not going to go away in a few months. Like, some of these things won't go away with time at all. So, I don't know. Some people are speculating that Apple is trying to get rid of the pro market and just not serve it anymore. I don't think that would be the case. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, going back to the whole rushing, I wonder about that too. Why rush this out? I really... part of me still really feels like this is just Apple's. Apple wants you to edit video in a certain way, and this is that way. And, you know, maybe there's a whole demographic of people who have come up through iMovie, the newer version of iMovie. They've come up using that over the last just couple of years, really. And they want to graduate to doing something a little bit more complicated. I don't know. It almost feels like Apple's leaving the door open for people to go and say, okay, we're going to use Premiere. We're going to use Avid or something. We're going to use something else. And maybe Apple's okay with that. And that really bothers a lot of the people who have, for years, relied on Final Cut Pro and do rely on Final Cut Pro and want to keep relying on Final Cut Pro for their stuff. And we had Adam Lissagor on the talk show to talk about that because he lives and breathes Final Cut Pro. That's how he does his work. You know, and this is a tool that he relies on and that he wants to use going forward. And it makes sense to me. Those people are kind of freaked out because this is the new version, this is the new way, and it's feature incomplete. It's just not, you know, to put this in a different perspective, what if, I mean, I know we have a lot of developers, but I'll use a design comparison here. What if Photoshop came out and you couldn't rotate images anymore? Well, of course you'd have to be able to rotate. Well, no, you just can't. That feature is not there. You can't rotate images. That's not. You can export your files out, and you can use a different application to export to rotate them, and then you can import them back in.
And also there was no more concept of pixels ever.
Right, and the pixels are gone, and you can't open your old Photoshop files. Right. You know, but this is the new way. Now, if Adobe did that, people would just fly away from Photoshop, except for the people who, again, have spent decades using it.
To what?
Well, I don't know. Then that's the thing, is that here there are other things that people can go to. They might not want to. If you ask Final Cut Pro users, do you want to go use Adobe Premiere? Do you want to go use Avid? Like Sandy yesterday, they'll say, no, I don't want to do that. I specifically don't want to do that. That's why I like Final Cut Pro. And Apple, for all these years, has encouraged innovation and encouraged creative people and supported us, supported this community, in some ways created this community of typically, you know, independent, smaller film and video shops to be able to do this stuff in an effective way. And now they don't want Apple to have abandoned them and left them to have to switch to Adobe Premiere. But by leaving out a lot of these features that the pro users really do rely on, they're not giving them a whole lot of options. Keep using the old version, which, by the way, you can't put on a new computer if you happen to buy one and still want to use your old one. And that was what I said.
That's a big issue.
Yeah, I'd said that to Adam too, is that what if you wanted to hire somebody and have them help? And he says, well, currently all the people that I would, you know, have as my assistants, they're going to have their own copy. But what if you wanted to hire somebody out of school or something? And here's your new computer, brand new employee, and you give her computer, and oh well, sorry, you have to run this new version, so we can't trade our work anymore. That's, you know, Apple took it away. Apple removed the ability for people to even buy the old one. So that's a big deal.
Yeah, that I think exacerbates most of the issues here. It's that Apple just said, you know, whatever you could do yesterday, all of a sudden now you cannot do today.
It's, right.
You can't just stick with the old version because you can't buy new licenses for it, as far as I know. I mean, I'm sure there's some retailers or something that still have it, but I think for the most part, you can't buy new licenses for it. And
it's almost like there's going to be a black market now for it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, had Apple just... I think John Gruber's idea of naming this Final Cut Express 10 would have been fine. I understand that's not really what Apple was going for. Like, they want this to be the way forward in the pro market. And I don't know whoever used Final Cut Express. Maybe education customers. I don't know. Because I don't think there's that much of a market for people to pay more than iMovie's cost of effectively zero, but who wouldn't need all the full pro features of Final Cut Pro. So I don't know how big that market was. But you know, and one thing, like, I don't think Apple is going to attract a lot of casual consumers with this. I think that's probably not what they're going for, because casual consumers don't spend $300 on software very often for very many reasons. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't think they're going for iMovie Plus here. A lot of people are speculating on that. I think that's not the case. This is obviously intended to be the real pro tool. it's intended to be bought by all the same people who bought Final Cut Pro so far. And because they can't buy the old version anymore, because they're now stuck with this, which often doesn't solve their needs, it feels like the rug's been pulled out from under them. Like, they built this whole business and workflow up on this tool that is suddenly no longer existing in the marketplace. You know, old copies will stick around for a while as people use them, but if you can't buy new copies, you effectively can't buy new computers, you can't hire more people. That's a big deal. And that's going to effectively kill it in the market fairly quickly, the old version, I mean. So I think the way Apple deals with this, ultimately, I think that what they have to do is they have to just keep selling the old version for a while, maybe a year, maybe 2 years, I don't know, a while. I don't know. Do you think they would do that?
Well, I want to say no.
I just don't know. They need to do that. Whether they will or not, I don't know.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I want to say no. I don't. You know, it's.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's tough, and this is the whole thing. Is that you have to wonder the to put this back into a developer version of it. You know, and this was something that John Gruber had pointed out. Apple, as much as they may make it difficult to get an app into the App Store for one reason or another. The tools that they give developers are pretty darn good. If they were to do this in that side of the house, the developers would be equally irate. So for all the people that are out there saying, oh, you know, boohoo, Cry Me a River, adapt and change your Switch apps. For a lot of people, there are no other apps. That's the thing. Avid's out there, Adobe Premiere's out. For a lot of people, that just doesn't matter. If I said Xcode is going to change and it's not going to be able to do things that you absolutely need it to do for your apps, what are you going to do? Where do you go? And everything else is pretty much not going to be usable the way you want it to be. What do you do? Well, I just won't make iOS apps anymore. I'll make HTML5 apps. You know, that's as different as it would be for a lot of these people who do things in Final Cut Pro to consider using Avid or consider using something else. It's just, it's a completely different framework for them.
Exactly. And I don't know. I don't see... I mean, you know, with developers, we had it easier because Xcode 4 came out a year ago and it still isn't required for anything yet. Like, you can still use Xcode 3 to develop things with the most recent SDK, I think. I actually haven't... I haven't checked about the 5.0 SDK.
And how old
yet,
is version 3? How long has that thing been around?
Oh, I have no idea. A while. Years. But yeah, I mean, version 4 was this kind of reboot of it. A lot of stuff was missing at first. They've added most of it back in. And it was buggy, it was limited, and they fixed a lot of that. It's still buggy. Xcode 4 is still very, very buggy. I can tell you that. But it's been out for a year already. And we could use it if we want to, but 3 is still around and we can use that too. For Apple to do this in a similarly pro type market with no changeover period is just bizarre. I would love to know what's going on behind the scenes here at Apple. Like, how did this happen? Who chose to do this? And like, was that well thought out by all the higher ups? I don't know. I mean, this is probably going to be the worst press Apple gets this year. I don't think even not having an iPhone at WWDC was not really bad press. This is probably going to be the worst press this year, and I'd love to know if this was intentional. Like, did they know they were going to anger this many people with this? If not, why not?
Yeah,
because a pro tool like this, usually you do a bunch of field testing, and you have pros use it and show you what's wrong with it before you release it and before you commit to it so heavily as they have done here. You know, by them canning the old version instantly and saying this is the way forward, period, with so much stuff missing, that's an incredibly ballsy move. And there's a pretty fine line between ballsy and stupid. And I think it's pretty clear here so far as far as we can tell from out here, this was a bad move. And Apple doesn't usually make bad moves of this scale. And that will anger so much of their market. Now, you know, the idea that they're giving up on pros completely is certainly worth considering. I don't think that's the case, but what if it is the case? Like, what if there's no more Mac Pro? What if they kill the Mac Pro after this? There's been these rumors that there's a Mac Pro update imminent, which would make sense since the Xeon E3 is out, but the E5 is not. So they could make a single socket one, not a dual socket one, unless they have a really, really, really big advance from Intel on the E5. But what if the next Mac Pro just doesn't even have a dual socket one? Think about that. Like, what? Like, yeah. That's very possible. If we could learn, like, today or next week or sometime in July, when all these rumors say the next Mac Pro is going to come out, there's a very, very good chance that if it comes out now, there's only single socket models, which means they have a limit of 6 cores total, and there's going to be a limit on overall performance. There's going to be fewer RAM slots than previous ones. They can certainly make the case a lot smaller as a result. They can use a different motherboard. They don't even have to use the Xeon line if they're making single socket models. If they're only making single socket models, they could use then all of Intel's consumer lines of desktop CPUs, which would drop costs. It would reduce performance certainly, but it would massively drop costs, and it would change a lot of things in the case. But if they do this, if they say no more dual socket Mac Pros and even possibly no more Xeons, that's going to really upset the pro, especially video people who need all the CPU power they can get. Because that from that point forward, then the Mac Pro will no longer be the fastest workstation that you can buy, or among the fastest workstations you can buy.
Yeah.
Then they might have to go over back to the PC world and go get some Dell Xeon workstation. And if you look at how things are lining up, that actually doesn't sound that far-fetched. So we'll see. I'm really curious to see the next Mac Pro, see what happens. You know, if so far we've heard lots of different rumors, so most of them are probably crap, but...
And, you know, they've kept that chassis. That's the same enclosure that they've had since the G5.
Exactly. I mean, they've changed... They've the internals inside are different.
The internals are great, but it's really the same thing. People have often asked me, oh, when are they going to change it? I'd just be surprised if they change it anytime soon. I really think that they're going to keep this. I really think that the Mac Pro will continue to be what it is, and it'll continue to stay the way it is with the most CPUs that are the most powerful and the most expansion. I just don't see them backing away from that.
See, I would say that I'd say that's like 80% likely. It's probably going to be the same. But I don't know. I think it depends on when it comes out. That's really it. If it comes out like next week or in July, there's a very good chance it's going to be a smaller scale machine because of the lack of a dual socket Xeon E5. So I don't know. We'll see. I don't think they really need to address the cheap desktop market anymore. You know, we all used to clamor for the X Mac that it would be this basically a cheap Mac Pro, a desktop Mac that used consumer CPUs, consumer motherboards, was like somewhere between $1,000 and $2,000 probably, and we could expand and we could put our own video cards in and we could put our own hard drives and memory and all that stuff, basically like the PC tower of the Mac world. And I think for the most part, a lot of factors have combined to significantly reduce the demand for that overall. Most notably, the iMac is really good now, and so that's I don't think they need to address that market. So in that case, I think you're right that they probably will just keep it the same. It'll probably still be a Xeon. It'll probably be one or two socket, and it'll be, you know, $6,000 for a well configured one, and that's it. And they just ignore everyone who doesn't want to be a part of that market. But I don't know. Whatever happens to the Mac Pro, I think it will illuminate the Final Cut situation a bit more. Because if they keep it the same, and they keep it as this big beefy Xeon thing, then I think we can definitively say they're not abandoning the Pro market.
Right.
If they kill the high end of it, though, then I think that narrative of they don't care about pros becomes a lot stronger. So we'll see.
We'd also like to say thanks to iStockPhoto.com. This is the world's original source. These guys invented this, as far as I know, for affordable user-generated, royalty-free stock images, media, and design elements. They do all of this. So it doesn't matter if you're a developer, a designer, blogger, whatever you are. You will find what you need here because they have over 8 million high-quality photos, illustrations, and clips that you can use to tell your story. They also have the most robust search tool in the business. This is a great, great place to go for everything. They've got a new editorial collection you need to check out, stuff from Veta and Agency, and tons of independent content. And you'll get a 10% discount on 50 or more iStock credits if you sign up before July 30th and you go to iStockPhoto.com/5x5. Say anything with iStock.
Let's see, what else happened this week? I have a big list of ancient questions, but what else happened this week?
I think we've hit some of the main things. I mean, I think the Google Plus thing, do you want to talk about that?
Well, I can't get into it. I tried. Somebody sent me an invite, and I clicked on it, and it said, oh, we're over capacity, even if you have an invite. Sorry.
Really?
I guess Google doesn't have that many servers. Who knows?
I guess that must be the problem.
Oh, we got to talk about the WebPad, TouchPad thing, whatever.
Yeah, that was my other... And HP has also announced that they're going to be... is this an announcement or a rumor that they're going to be licensing WebOS potentially? But it, you're right. I think it is just a rumor.
The big thing with the TouchPad... So the HP TouchPad is, I think, officially out tomorrow? Yeah, right? July 1st? I think it's officially out July 1st, which is tomorrow at the time of recording. And... all the reviews came out last night, like yesterday evening. I guess the embargo broke probably like yesterday at 5 or something. And so all the reviews came out. And they're all remarkably consistent. They all basically say that the hardware is pretty nice, but it's kind of plasticky and thick and bulky. The hardware basically is an all-plastic interpretation of the iPad 1. Would you say that's accurate?
Very accurate. My little boy was watching a show, and I think they had a commercial for it, and he said, "Oh, it that looks like the old iPad."
That's awesome.
Yeah. He's 3.5, so yeah, they're not really innovating on the side of design wise. But that's
pretty impressive that he not only said that it looks like an iPad, but that it looks like the old iPad.
Well, that's because his is the old one, and mine is the new one, and he's not allowed to touch mine. His has a big, bumpy, you know, chubby case around it.
Right, yeah. So anyway, so HP, and I've talked about this before, I think it's kind of shameful how much they ripped off a lot of the iPad hardware stuff. The software, they did an okay job of differentiating in a lot of ways, but the hardware, I think they ripped off directly. And it just kind of makes me sad that they couldn't think of something better. You know, they couldn't try to be their own a little bit more. Mm. But anyway... the reviews are all pretty consistent in that the hardware is thick and bulky, and the plastic feels cheap. That it's heavy. The OS is really good in most ways. It's well designed. It looks nice. The multitasking methods and interface are really good. The major downsides are that it's buggy, and that performance still suffers. And this is really, I think, worth talking about. So WebOS is largely based on web rendering stuff. It's based on JavaScript, HTML, CSS for much of its interface. I don't know the details of how much, but I know it's a lot. And that's most apps are written using those web languages and are presumably rendered using WebKit or something based on WebKit, I think. The point is that it's all using things that are not natively compiled technologies. It's not compiling down from C to assembly and, you know, to bytecode, to native code. So the result is that WebOS has always had this problem of being sluggish. Even from the original Palm Pre, all the reviews said, yeah, this is pretty good, but it's kind of slow. It's kind of sluggish. And... you know, I don't. I guess they were gambling on hardware getting faster over time. That, you know, were, you know, very similar. I think you said on Hypercritical, I think John Siracusa said that that, you know, back when OS X first came out and they had all of these all the new window buffering methods and all these, it was actually slower for a while. But they were gambling on faster hardware in the future and you know, coming out fairly soon and relieving them of the, of this problem of being slow. Well, in WebOS, that hasn't happened yet. And I think at this point, the CPU in the touchpad is really good. It's, I think it's very similar to the iPad 2 CPU in that it's a dual-core Cortex-9, whatever Apple's naming is confusing.
I think it's A5, A4. I, you know what?
Well, Apple calls it the A5, but I think then that maps to the Cortex A9 dual core.
Yeah, and Siracusa would know, but he's the only one that does know or cares.
Excuse me. So, anyway, it pretty much has the same hardware as the iPad 2, like the same CPU, and I don't know how much RAM it has. It doesn't really matter. Probably the same amount. So, overall, it should be really fast, but it still isn't. And that's really saying a lot that you have this really, really fast CPU. Really, you know, modern, high-end. You look at what it does on the iPad. It's amazing. It's fast. And in WebOS, it's still sluggish. And that's the number one complaint, is besides the bulkiness, is that it's sluggish. Everything, like touching things, dragging them, scrolling, rotation, it's just slow. And Apple, as many of your hosts have pointed out, Apple has done a very good job over time of keeping iOS fairly responsive. Even at the very beginning, they did tons of crazy tricks with the iPhone 1 to make it so that when you touched a list and scrolled it, it moved like so quickly. It tracked your finger so precisely with lots of fast performance behind the scenes, that it really felt like you were manipulating that list with your finger, like it felt like a physical object that you were scrolling, which makes everything feel better. You feel like you're more in control. You feel happier. It's more delightful to use. Everything about that feels better for the user. And Android has had this problem to a great extent over time with just scrolling performance, animation performance. WebOS has always had this problem the worst, I think, because it's based on so many high-level technologies, and it's so far from the metal in many cases. So, but you know, if it, back the original Palm Pre had this issue on much slower hardware than what's in the touchpad, if the touchpad still has this issue, it might not be just raw horsepower. It might be architectural issues that they have, like actual bottlenecks that are not just solved by hardware.
You know, but it's funny. I mean, you have to look at iOS. You have to look at the iPhones and the iPads. And you have to say a big part of the reason these things are so successful is because Apple has spent so much time trying to make, and look, go back to the way that the Apple used to talk about the original Mac and their computers in general. They wanted to make these things like appliances, like devices that people already had, whether it was your refrigerator, your stereo, or your TV. They wanted you to have the same kind of feelings that you could just go up to it and use it. And one of the biggest barriers and the biggest confusing things that I had when I was using the Palm Pre Plus, which I had as my main phone for a number of months, was it was not responsive. So let me go back and tell you about this GPS that I have in my car sure. right now. It's a Garmin. I think it is Garmin, right? Is that how I say it?
Probably.
I always mess this stuff up.
Who knows?
And this thing is absolutely horrible. And there was a firmware or software update that I thought would help it, but it actually has made it slower. So here's the way it works. You go and you turn the thing on. Every single time you have to type in the city, it can't remember or store what city you're in. And like, you know what, I understand that maybe you want to be driving to a different city. But, you know, and I don't want to take too much time griping about this thing. But the point is this, you have to tell it how you want to enter it. Then you enter the thing, it makes you enter the city. So you type A-U-S. Now, as you're typing, as you hit the S, and then you start to hit the T for Austin, it then says, well, you've entered enough. I'm going to show you the options, the only options I know of in the United States of America that match A-U-S. But you were foolish enough to continue to type, and you've typed the T.
Right.
And even though I was displaying a T to you to type on, you have already pressed where the T was, but I, in my mind, I was already trying to display the next screen to you. So I've slid the next screen under, and what happens to be under the T was actually a whole different menu selection that you pressed before I even displayed it to you. And now you're on this second thing. Why are you now editing, you know, voice settings and trying to make me sound like an Australian man instead of an American woman because you hit the where the T was is actually that setting. It's that kind of thing. You would run into this a lot, not quite as bad on WebOS, where you'd tap something and it would either not register immediately or it would register a little. Yeah, it was just that feeling of just a little bit of disconnectedness from the device that you're using makes you not trust it. You don't trust.
Right.
I totally don't trust the GPS at all.
You feel like you're not in control.
You totally feel like you're not in control. Whereas with any iOS app, even the bad ones, you really feel like you're interfacing directly with the hardware. You're moving the hardware around, if that makes any sense. And it astounds me that WebOS wouldn't have put that first and foremost above all everything else. Is it because they're using web technologies? Can those things, you know, because you're essentially writing everything in JavaScript, right? Is it just-in-time compiling, or do they get compiled? How does that work?
I don't know for sure. I'm not familiar enough with it. I assume that they have a really nice JIT compiler, and they, I mean, they probably do everything right with web technologies. Maybe that's not the problem. Maybe the problem is other stuff. Maybe it's like underlying, you know, just like their, some of their core libraries or, you know, whatever the web stuff is interacting with. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's all the system libraries, like the windowing layer and stuff like that. I don't know. That
you would think that this would be their number one thing to fix. If the only thing that they've changed in the update of the operating system was responsiveness to make it immediate. Because that really is, and this was, you know, go back to the early days of Windows, whenever you could tell if you sat down in front of a Mac running system 6 or 7, there was something about, and it's very hard to put your finger on, people will today reminisce back about it and say, oh, it was, you know, the Mac screens were slightly higher DPI or the mouse had a slightly higher DPI. Whatever it was, it really felt like when you moved that mouse, you were moving the cursor, you were manipulating the hardware itself directly. Whereas on Windows, it always felt like a layer. It felt like a layer. There was a program that was running that was saying, hey, he's moving the mouse, move the cursor. Whereas on the Mac, it was just you were moving the cursor with your hand. And that didn't really change. Some would argue it still hasn't changed in Windows. I think it's pretty much on par and has been on par for a while. But it's that you need to feel connected. You need to be able to trust this device to enjoy using it. And if they haven't hit this, we're in trouble.
Yeah. Also, I mean, if you read the reviews, so many of them, I liked Jason Snell's Macworld review. That was really good. So many of the things, like you can tell he's trying to be really nice about it. And
right.
But so many of the things like, this is supposed to do this, but it didn't work when I tried it. And then, oh yeah, they had this great store, but I couldn't get it to work. Oh yeah, and this cool pairing thing with a phone, but oh, that didn't work for me either. It seems like there's a lot of bugs. And, you know, if you look at when the iPad launched, if think back, I don't know the exact timing of this, but the iPad launched with version 3.2 of iOS. They didn't ship an update to its software for months after that. It was a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And somebody should look up the exact timing. Chat room nerds, maybe? All right. So seriously, they went so long before updating the software on the iPad. And then when they finally made a 3.2.1, I think it was just because of some browser buffer overflow thing. Like, it was a very minor update to fix like one security hole or something like that. It wasn't like a massive feature update to replace all the built-in apps with better versions or anything. Like, the version they shipped with the iPad 1 was extremely stable. It was shocking. A brand new platform, all this new stuff in it. You know, some of it they got from the iPhone, but, you know, a lot of it they didn't. A lot of it they had to do brand new, all the new interface stuff, and it was all rock solid from the very beginning. look at all the tablets that are coming out so far, where they're having like the RIM playbook, which might even be dead now. That like they were shipping updates to it during the reviewer's review period,
right?
And like many of them, not just one, like many updates. And it sounds like the touchpad is similarly unfinished, and it will probably also be receiving lots of software updates over the next few months, or even few weeks. And then you look at the iPad 1, came out rock solid, nothing, like no updates, no problems, no bugs.
And people might say, oh, well, that's because they already had gotten a whole lot of stuff done with the iPhone. The
WebOS
existed, phones. But that's my point there, is that, yeah, WebOS already had the phone too. Right. And they've had, and it's been out for years.
I think BlackBerry's the only one that had like a totally from scratch new OS for their bad tablet. All the other bad tablets had something to build on. So, you know, and so many of the reviews are also saying there's really not that much reason to buy this over an iPad. And so, you know, you have to ask, same thing with the Google Circles thing. Like I blogged about this yesterday. Like, why would somebody use this instead of Facebook? And there are certainly some reasons. So I guess the better question is, why would a lot of people use this instead of Facebook? What's going to take, what about this is going to take people out of Facebook, make them stop using it if they already were using it, and switch to this? So same thing here. Like, what's going to make somebody look at an iPad and look at an HP touchpad and choose the HP? And similarly, you don't need this as much because the market is not nearly as saturated as social networks. But what's going to make somebody who currently likes iPads and uses the iPad buy an HP touchpad for their next purchase instead of an iPad?
And that's the question. That's the question they absolutely have to give a compelling answer to that they haven't.
Exactly. If there aren't compelling reasons for a lot of people to do that, it's not going to work because there's already a major player in this market. If this was a brand new market and Apple wasn't here yet, you know, like back, if you think about back in the iPad or the iPod days, it's even hard to say iPod these days. Wow. think about the iPod days. The iPod was not the first small hard drive based MP3 player. I think it was the first one that small. But back right before it came out, there were a bunch
of
other
Diamond Rio had a lot of them, right?
I don't think that was hard drives.
Oh, no, no, I'm sorry.
The only other one that had a hard drive at the time was this big creative blob lump thing that
it was like
the size of a Discman. Well, yeah, I think there were two. I think the Arcos jukebox was already out, or some kind of like Arcos thing was this giant rectangle, because they used 3.5-inch discs. And then, well, there was one that used I think they used 2.5-inch discs. But the iPod from the beginning, I think, used the 1.8-inch disc and was therefore much slower as a result. But anyway, the iPod was not the first hard drive MP3 player. It entered this market. And all the other ones before the iPod came out, they were doing okay. You know, they were selling in small volume. They were all very expensive, and most people didn't need something that advanced. But they were all doing okay. If you launched something like the touchpad into a market like that, where there's a bunch of small players doing okay, but no one's the clear winner, then it would stand a chance, because then everyone's kind of still looking around, and there's people are more experimental in their purchasing decisions. It's still a growing small market. Some might argue that's the case with the iPad. I don't think it is. You know, some people are saying, well, they've only sold X million of them, so there's still a massive market to be had. And that's true. There's certainly something to that. But the iPad had such a massive lead, and both in time and in user preference and in quality, that it's almost as though it's already saturated the market, in the sense that I think it's saturated the consumer's view of the market, at least. But entering this market now with something that is not a massively obvious major winner versus the other competitors, I think you're pretty much dead. I mean, look, the RIM playbook has gone nowhere. The rumors are that they're canning it already. The Motorola Zoom has gone nowhere. The Samsung ripoff tabs have gone nowhere. You know, and not to say that they've sold zero units, but that no one is saying that they're killing the iPad. You know, no one's saying they're even really competing with it at this point. And from all intents and purposes, it looks like the touchpad is probably going to have the same fate. It's probably going to go nowhere as well. The iPad is so good and so established. You have to come out swinging. You have to have a massively better thing from day one. And I just don't see it happening yet. From all the ones we've seen so far, it hasn't happened. Maybe, you know, as we talked about a lot last episode, maybe the Amazon future thing that might exist, maybe that'll do it through some other way. I don't know. So far, nothing we've seen is good enough to get significant market share, except the iPad. Anyway.
That's a good point. And people will often cite a lot of those reasons that, well, you know, we need more apps. And then did you read the piece recently by David Hanemeyer Hansen saying, I forget what it was called, he's one of the co-founders of 37 Signal, saying, give me 10 apps, or all he needs is 10 apps.
Hey, that's worth talking about, too. Yeah. So, yeah, we're almost out of time, but I'll give a bit of time.
You can do more. I have time today.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I also don't want to have like a two-hour long.
You don't want to have a two? Okay.
So
people will be upset if we don't do a two-hour show.
And they will be upset if we do one.
Yeah, it's just a question of where will more people be upset.
So a big thing with the gist of his post was like, you know, you don't need 200,000 apps for a platform to do well. And his argument was that he only uses 10 apps, and if you can do those 10 apps well, he's pretty much fine. So the problem here is that it's kind of like the 80-20 fallacy, which is some common wisdom in the industry is that 80% of the users only use 20% of the features.
All right.
And then as a result, well, you only have to implement 20% of the features and then you'll get 80% of the users. But that's actually a fallacy, because the reality is like that the 20% of features that each of those members of the 80% uses are not the same features for all members of the 80%. So it's not like they aren't using the same 20% of the features. There might be a lot of overlap. Like, I bet if you ask everyone who has an iPhone, like, you know, which 10 apps would you, if you could only have 10 apps, which ones would you pick? I bet you'd see a lot of overlap. I bet a lot of people pick, you know, Mail, Safari, I assume the phone and messaging apps. You know, maybe the weather app, maybe this, you know, some people might pick stocks, but then now you're getting more narrow. But I think like apps 7 through 10 that those people would pick would be very, very different for each person. Some people might pick a Twitter app, an RSS app. I would pick Instapaper because I'm biased, but I use it. And you know, like it very quickly becomes a long tail at that point of, you know, what if somebody uses like this running fitness tracker every day, like our friend Lucius has Couch to 5K. That is an app that's going to be really important to some of those people, so they're going to put that in their 10. But other people, like if I'm dieting, I use Lose It to count calories. That would be one of my 10 apps. I like looking things up in Wikipedia, so that would be one of my 10 apps. You know, my 10 are going to be very different from a lot of other people's 10. Even if we share the same, like, you know, 1 through 6 or 1 through 5. So there's one big issue of that, which is some people like different types of apps and they're very important to them. Then a whole other issue is replacements of built-in apps, of things that in your opinion are better. So for instance, like I use MyCast as my weather app because it's really good. I use Plain Text as my note app because it's really good. And these each do things differently than the built-in apps because in ways that make them better suited to me and that give them more value to me. I use Solver as my calculator. All sorts of things like that where the built-in app, yeah, it works. It's good. And if I had to use only it, I'd probably get by. But I'm happier and I'd rather have the choice. I'm happier to have all these alternatives. And the bigger your platform is, generally speaking, the more alternatives you have. So it's not that you only need 10 apps. or rather, it's not that a platform can get by with only having 10 good apps. You need the diversity and size of the third-party marketplace to both solve less common needs and to provide variety in the common needs. And none of these other platforms are going to have as much of that. Even Android on the phone, which is a massive market with, so far, a lot of apps. I've never used an Android phone full-time, so I can't really judge, but you have. Did you find, when you were using an Android phone full-time, were there ever times where like you had a need for a particular type of app and you searched and there just wasn't one, or there wasn't a really good one worth using?
You know, this. To be fair, I have to say this was a while ago. I switched back to the iPhone 4 when it came to Verizon. So I can.
It's not that long ago.
It's not, but.
Like 6 months ago.
I can say that I could pretty much find an app that would, you know, that was designed to do whatever it was that I was looking for it to do. Typically, and this is going to sound harsh, oh, he's, you know, he's an iPhone guy, whatever. I really wanted to get apps that I really liked. Typically I was able to find an app that would do most, if not everything, that I would want it to do. Typically using the app would be very unpleasant, like using all of Android was at that time. You know, it wasn't great. I never had fun using the phone or any of the apps. Is that a requirement? No, it got the job done. Typically I had apps that, you know, that helped with whatever it was that I needed to do, whether it was utility apps or fun apps or whatever. You know, you could do it. It was a utilitarian type thing. It wasn't always a beautiful user interface or user experience, but it got the job done. And if, you know, so for there, a lot of the people, and I was really content to be on the Android phone because it did do what I needed it to, but I didn't ever enjoy using it. And if that's not important to you, which for me, it was easy for me to say, you know, it's not that important. What's important for me is to be able to make phone calls reliably, because it's a phone first and a device second still. Then I didn't care. It was the best I could get on Verizon. Well, when the iPhone came to Verizon, I switched. I said, man, I actually like using this thing. And I use my iPhone tons more than I used my Android phone. I used my Android phone specifically for things. I need to do this. I will use this device to do this task. And that might be making a phone call. It might be using a calculator, briefly browsing the web, checking email. That was it. I use the iPhone just because I enjoy using it. So that it's not like a problem or anything. But if I can find an excuse to use it, I will. I never did that with Android. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So first, I think it's worth pointing out, the reason I asked about Android in particular is because Android, I think, is the most competitive. Android on, and even just Android on phones, certainly not on tablets yet. But I think Android is the most competitive to Apple right now, especially in this area of discussion of like app breadth and quality. So this is like the best case scenario outside of the Apple world, I think, is the Android market right now. And even a lot of things about what you just said sound like, and by the way, I don't mean to imply that any type of app need on iOS has good solutions, because certainly that's not the case. Many of them have no good solutions. They have the same problem in a lot of cases where you search for something, an app to do something, and you do get apps, but they kind of suck. And all of them kind of suck in different ways. That is always the case on iOS too. No question, like a lot of what you search for, that's the case. But I've heard from people who have tried both more than I have, including you, that on Android, overall, the app quality is worse in that you can't find a good solution to a lot more problems. And what you just said was interesting. You said it wasn't fun, and you don't just pick up the Android phone. It's more of utilitarian. I think tablets are, I think, more important to be fun, because a phone is something you always have in your pocket, and most people who have phones need to have a phone for whatever reason. You know, they're not going to just go without it. They're not going to like leave their phone at home all day because they don't really care that much about it. A tablet, though, is like a fun device. It's a frivolous device for most uses. You don't really need a tablet. Most tablet buyers, I don't think, are replacing a computer with it. You know, it's not like you need this device all day every day. So for a tablet, it really is like a casual, almost like an entertainment computer for a lot of people. It's what, you know, a lot of people use it just to play games, and just, you know, or just casually browse the web or read stuff. It needs to be fun. It needs to be delightful to use. It needs to, because that's the first, it needs to convince you to buy it. And because it's not going to really replace a phone or a computer for a lot of buyers, it has to be so good and so fun and so compelling that you just want one. You don't really care that it's not that practical or price efficient. You just want one. And so it has to be fun. It has to have all those tangible benefits. It has to have fast scrolling. It has to be delightful to use. And I'm not sure that you can look at any other tablet competitor and say that it comes anywhere close in this department. I don't know that you could look at anything that we've seen from Android and say this is really fun and this is really delightful in the tablet space. The phones, there's so many, I don't know. I can't even keep track, so I don't know. Yeah,
tablets are sort of easier to peg. And also that's where a lot of the attention is being spent by both the customers and the consumers as well right now. I mean, tablet, you know?
Exactly. And
that's really because it's a new industry. It's a new market. You think, oh, phones have been around forever. But, you know, gosh, we can't compete with that. So this tablet will give us some space. But it does. Right. It's apparently not.
Right. Exactly. And I just don't see this changing anytime soon. So quickly on Google Circles. Yeah. I guess we talk about tablets every episode, so I want to move on past that now.
Right.
Google Circles or Google Plus. My God, I can't even figure out what this thing's called. First of all, it's a terrible name because Google Plus looks a lot like Google. Like, you're going to get that confused. You're going to say, oh, I was using Google. And your friends are going to know what you're talking about. So that's a bit of an issue. Even like the whole, we talked about like the whole Plus One. That's such like a nerd thing.
Is that, I mean, a Google Plus? Is it Circles? I mean, it's just, there's all these new little things.
Yeah. Like, you can just say I'm using Facebook and everyone knows what that is. So even if you do get into Google Plus and like it a lot and want to invite people to it or talk about it or tell people to get on it, what do you say? do you type out the plus, the symbol? Do you write out the word plus? You know, it's, I don't know. Google percent 20 or whatever? No, I don't know. So there's that issue. The demo site to it. Did you play with the demo?
Not very much. I mean, I've got an account, so I've been using the...
Oh, you do have an account.
Yeah.
I don't even have that yet. I got it. Please don't invite me. I got invites already. I clicked on when they didn't work. But I really want to join it organically, which is that I want to join it when I feel the need to join it, which might never happen. But, you know, I want... I joined Twitter only when I had a need to join Twitter. Now I love it. I use it every day. But I joined Twitter when I was working at Tumblr and we were building in Twitter functionality and I had to test it. That's when I joined Twitter.
Hmm.
And so I want to join this when I have a good reason to, which is probably going to either be testing it for Instapaper use somehow, or when I have social pressure to join it, when my friends are doing things in this network that I want to be a part of. That's why most people join social networks. It's the social pressure from people who are already in them, and at some point they become so ubiquitous that
you kind of have to.
Yeah, like you get left out if you're not in them. Like you start missing when get-togethers happen, or you, like everyone's talking about some baby picture they posted on there, and you haven't seen it. You know, that's kind of thing. The problem is they attacked Facebook head on. You know, usually the way you attack a massive established business is you do something a little bit different. I think business people call it the blue ocean strategy. I don't know. There's a book, there's an ocean on the cover. I don't know. So, but I think the idea here is you create a whole new market that will take away from the established market, but not head on. Like people didn't beat Microsoft by making desktop operating systems and office suites. No one's going to beat Google by making a better web search. It's just not happening. Microsoft is trying, but it's going okay, but through brute force. But it's not killing Google. No one's saying Bing is killing Google. Even like Apple, like you could argue no one's going to beat the iPad by making a 10-inch tablet that looks a lot like it.
Yeah.
Works similarly, but not quite as well, and has no ecosystem around it. So to take down Facebook.
And that is, I mean, that is very, very much the goal. That's what the goal is.
It seems right. Like that. You know, and you can think about defensively, maybe they have to. Like, I think we talked about before, like Facebook has so much data and people are spending so much time just in Facebook. It actually is taking away from Google's business. It is actually hurting Google how well Facebook is doing, because all that time they're not using Google. And they're not using Google services, and if Facebook wanted to launch competing services against Google's, they're in a pretty good position to do a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them. So Google had to respond somehow to Facebook to try to compete with them on their turf. And they've tried all this social stuff in the past that has always gone pretty much nowhere. You know, at Google scale, nowhere can still be like tens of millions of users, but hasn't really been massively successful. So they had to do something. I don't know what else they could have done. Like, because I'm not smart enough to see like the next big thing in our industry, to see like, here's how you make social networks less relevant by doing X. I don't see that yet. So I guess Google, and apparently they don't know it either. So they made the exact same thing, sort of, in some ways. But the problem is you can't just start a brand new empty social network from scratch and expect it to do well. For the same reason, you can't just start a brand new web search engine. Like, Google knows better than anybody how hard web search is and how incredibly time and money intensive it is to build it up and to keep it running and to keep it going. Social networks are very similar. They're like, Facebook does a lot. Facebook is the biggest photo sharing site on the internet. You don't usually think of Facebook as a photo sharing site, but in addition to all the other ridiculous things it does, it's also that. So to compete with it, you also have to be a ridiculously good photo sharing site. And like, it has messaging, it has events, it has all these like kind of side features that are so widely used and really are required for people who are using these things. You can't just come in and say, oh, I'm going to post what I like, and that's it. It has to be more than that if you're competing directly with Facebook. And like, I think Tumblr got away with this just fine because, A, it started years ago when Facebook wasn't this big. But Tumblr is not trying to be Facebook. Tumblr is its own thing. It's this publishing platform and this content sharing network. Twitter, very similar. Twitter started a long time ago as well. It is this different thing. It's not trying to be Facebook. It's not trying to be a social network. The way Facebook is, but Google is really attacking them head on, and I don't see it working very well so far. Now, who knows? They're gonna promote the heck out of it. I can guarantee you that. They're redesigning their little top navigation bar. They are gonna put this everywhere. But they also did that with Google Buzz, and it didn't go anywhere. So it's not a guarantee it's gonna succeed. Google Chat, they did that. Google Chat, they angered every Gmail user at some point by shoving Google Chat in their face much more often than they wanted it. And that actually did work. Google Chat actually has taken off, and it's doing okay. But yeah, like they're going to promote the heck out of this thing, and it might work, it might not. The problem I see is when you go to this for the first time, let's say you're actually convinced to check it out. And let's assume that they actually let you in at that point, because right now it's ridiculous that people who want to check it out are told to leave, which is, I'm sure there's a good reason for that, but I have yet to see it. Can you think of a good reason for that?
I sure can't.
Anyway, so assuming that you're interested and you get to it in the future and you want to check it out and you want to start using it, you're going to get there. It's going to be mostly empty because not everyone has switched to it yet. The whole world doesn't use it yet. You go to Facebook and you can be sure that most people you know are on there. You know, even, I mean, my grandparents are on Facebook. Everyone's on Facebook.
Right.
You go to this thing, it's going to be pretty empty. There will be a few geek friends of yours who are doing the same thing as you, trying it out, kind of poking around. Whoever got you to try it is probably on it. So, you know, you'll have a few people to interact with. But the motivation for you to come back in the future and to build a habit out of going there every day or going there regularly, you're only going to get that motivation if there's a lot of people there. And this is the big difficulty in starting a new network effect site. Like, if you went to a new auction site that was not eBay and you wanted to sell something and you listed it and there were, like, you know, two bids over a week and you didn't get a lot of money at the end of it, why would you ever go back to that auction site? Similarly, if you're a buyer looking at an auction site and it only has like 10 things on it that you're interested in, you know, and they're not good prices, and like, why would you ever go back? This is a problem with anything that has major network effects. Why would you use an IM network,
right,
that only two of your friends use and the other 25 people you want to talk to on IM are on the other network? Like, you wouldn't go back. So it isn't enough to just attract people. You have to keep them there. So it's a very, very hard sell. You have to convince people to come to an empty social network, and then you have to convince them to use it on a regular basis and not just abandon it and forget about it.
Right. Give them something to come back for, and not just because all their friends are there, but their friends are coming back too.
Exactly. And that's really, really hard. And it's not the kind of problem you can just throw money at and throw engineering talent at. You can't engineer your way out of that difficulty. You can try to be clever, and you can try, like with Google Chat, one of the reasons that worked is because it piggybacked on Gmail. But email and chat kind of go hand in hand. It makes sense that you're going to want to chat with a lot of people you email with. But by the way, even that hasn't worked incredibly well. It just worked acceptably. But social networks are very different. You have all these social conventions and awkwardnesses and complex situations. By the way, I mean, can you think of a worse company to design social interaction than Google?
Yeah, it really doesn't make
sense.
Facebook
is pretty bad at it in a lot of ways too. Facebook is like, define this complex emotional relationship with a series of checkboxes.
And you know what's funny is that a lot of companies, and we're just sort of criticizing some of them right now, is that a lot of companies will come in and they will copy another company. We were just talking about that with HP potentially copying the iPad 1 to some degree. If you think about that, Google is, in a way, it's like they're trying to copy it, but they're not. They still get things wrong. They still get that social interaction stuff wrong.
Right. Well, and it can't. And the thing is, it can't be an exact copy, because if it's a direct copy
right,
of like everything feature by feature, it just looks like a knockoff, and people don't really react that well to that usually. And then that raises the much bigger question. Okay, well, why should I even use this instead of the one I already know? So, you know, if Google really did just clone all of Facebook's features and not really do a lot their own way, then it would be even worse, because then it would just, you know, nobody would really care to use it. Like, well, why don't I just use Facebook? Just like in the tablet market, it's like, why don't I just buy an iPad instead of all these other things that are very, very similar to it? So Google has done some things that look pretty different. I don't know. The demo site I thought was terrible. Like, you're like zoomed in with this giant image that you're zoomed too far into by default, and you have to like zoom out and pan around. And what was that supposed to be for? Because it sure as hell didn't make me want to explore it. Like, I could not believe how difficult that was to use. I can't imagine anybody going to that, or I can't imagine a good people wanting to know more about it after trying to interact with that stupid demo site. It was like, why did they build this weird zooming thing? Why didn't they just have a regular website like everyone else that we know how to use, that is easy to browse? Like, they had to do their crazy Google thing, and look how cool we are. Look what we can do. It's the, you know, it's the engineering thing. Here's something we can do, not necessarily because we should do it, but we can do it, so we're going to do it. And that, to me, like, I haven't actually used the service yet because I can't get in again, but if the service is designed like that, it's going to have some issues. If it's designed to please the engineers working on it, to let them play with cool things, instead of do things that are good for customers and make sense and are easy to use, it's going to have problems. But anyway, I think, you know, so they didn't copy Facebook directly. You know, the circles thing is kind of interesting.
I want you to get in there and use it. Get in there and use
it. I'm trying. I have two different invites. Neither of them work.
Are you signed in from another account, from like a Google Apps account? Because some Google Apps accounts won't maybe let you use it.
I have no idea. I don't think so. But anyway, I'll play with it later if I can get in. But I'm going to have the same issue, I think, that I'm speculating everyone else will have, which is like, yeah, sure, I'll play with it. And then what's going to make me go back? Why would I go back to that after I play with it the first time and see like the four people I know who are going to be on it? And I'm unusual and I'm a nerd. So four people I know will actually be there already.
You know, I'll tell you one thing. If enough people, and here's part of it, is that after you're signed in, if you just go to Google, there are these sort of subtle cues and indications that you are going to be using, you know, that you could be using Google Plus or Circles or whatever. I mean, there are these little cues there that things are connected. The little plus one shows up on search results now and things like that. And my guess is that kind of sweeping integration at least is their hope as to, well, anytime you use Google, technically you'll have immediate access and visibility to these other great new things that we're rolling out just for you and your friends. That's kind of the feeling and impression that I get. And that's why I need you to get in there and use it, because I want to hear your take on it.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I guess I'll try to get in, but.
You got to get in.
I'm not that into Google services as most people. Like, I don't use Gmail. That's the big one. I don't use Gmail. So I'm not that hooked into all their new stuff they launch, and I don't really see a lot of the promos for it because I'm not living in it all the time like a lot of.
I don't ever use Gmail either, by the way, but I use Google Search constantly.
Yeah, I use Search and I use Maps, and that's about it, I think. And I use those a lot, but yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, I think let's wrap it up.
Let's wrap it up. So we'll be back next week. If you would like to follow Marco Arment. He is Marco Arment on Twitter. You can also go to marco.org, which I applaud you for registering.
Thank you.
And is it instapaper.com/blog or blog.instapaper.com? I can never get it straight.
It's blog.
Okay. So you can go there to find out about the FBI stealing his stuff or taking his stuff or not.
And yeah, who knows?
And that's about it for this week. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks again to our sponsors, FieldNotesBrand.com and iStockPhoto.com/5x5 for making this show possible. Please stop by 5x5.tv and check out older episodes of this show and all of the other shows. I've been making incremental improvements to the site, and I'd love to hear what you think. You can do that by going to 5x5.tv/contact. And, of course, as always, please rate the show on iTunes. It really is the single best way to help new people find out about the show. And we appreciate your support. Thanks again to everybody who's been donating. Really, really means a lot. You can go to 5x5.tv/donate to do that. And don't forget, keep up with Marco's stuff at marco.org. Great writing there. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you all again next week.